This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. Our theme today is energy policy. And in Nebraska, there is a sudden effort to reopen the flooded Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant. We'll be speaking live with Joe Jordan of Nebraska Watchdog about that maneuver. Also, Harvey Wasserman speaks with us about the overall state of nuclear operations in the United States, Japan, and elsewhere. Then we'll be joined by Antonia Juhas, speaking about petroleum policy and a follow-up to the Chevron oil refinery fire in California. All that and more coming up on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and there are rapid developments taking place in Nebraska, near Omaha, at the site of the Fort Calhoun nuclear power station. That is the one that last year was flooded with the melting of the winter snows upriver from that location and the entry of water into the basement and many other problems. There is now a sudden maneuver to rush the reopening of Fort Calhoun by turning over its operation from the Omaha Public Power District to a private corporation. We are now joined live by Joe Jordan of the Nebraska Watchdog. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Joe.
Good afternoon, Robert. How are you?
Just fine. You've been doing some great investigative work out there. Take a moment to tell people, what is the Nebraska Watchdog?
Well, Nebraska Watchdog is an online news website. We are specializing in investigative reporting and political reporting in the Midwest, specifically Nebraska, Omaha, Lincoln, and other parts of our region. We've been up and running since 2009, and I've been a reporter, television and radio reporter for 39 years.
Well, Joe, you came across a most curious development this week in regard to the Fort Calhoun plant, and apparently there is a sudden surreptitious effort to privatize the operation of it. Can you tell us what you know so far?
Well, what happened, as you've already told the listeners, last year the Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant, which is located just about 20 miles north of Omaha, and we've got a population in this area roughly about 1 million people, all told. So the power plant was shut down in April of 2011, a routine shutdown, and then the Missouri River flooded, and the plant shut down because they were concerned about any water damage that could occur to the plant. And there was some concern that the plant, you know, could become a safety hazard. While the plant was shut down in June of 2011, there was a fire inside the plant, which, because the plant was shut down, didn't cause a great deal of alarm. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission late 2011, it came back with a report that said that it was a significant safety lapse on the part of the operators of the plant, and that had the plant been up and running, it could have been a serious safety hazard here in this area. So the plant remained shut down, and to this day, the plant is shut down. We're going on 17 months now since the nuclear power plant has been up and running. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been to Omaha and this area four times for public hearings with the Omaha Public Power District, which runs the plant, and I can tell you from talking to other individuals involved in this type of safety issue with nuclear power plants, four public hearings is pretty unusual. So it's a clear indication that the power plant here is under the thumb of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they want something done soon if it's going to go back online. Now, having talked with several different people who work at the plant and operate the plant, they weren't getting anywhere. They were having a great deal of difficulty getting the plant to where they thought it would pass a Nuclear Regulatory Commission safety inspection. Nobody knew when the plant was going to reopen. There was some inkling that maybe it could come this December, but nothing was written in stone, and the NRC wouldn't say. Then, pretty much out of the blue, last Thursday night at a regular meeting regular monthly meeting of the Omaha Public Power District Board of Directors, and these are elected individuals. In Nebraska, we have public power, and that's how it's been for some 60, 70 years here. So these are elected officials. They voted unanimously to give the managers of the Omaha Public Power District the authority to put together a contract with a private company called Exelon, which I know operates a variety of nuclear power plants in the east where you are, in Illinois, outside of Chicago and what have you. And the curious part about that is there was no indication from the board or management that this deal was in the works. So it pretty much hit everybody out of the blue when Thursday night the board voted unanimously to grant the authority to the managers of the district to enter into a contract with Exelon. And the reason that it's significant for a couple of reasons, Robert. First of all, as I said, public power has been the norm here in Nebraska for years and years, and now to have a private company come in and run the nuclear power plant is a great divergence from where this area goes in terms of the way people like things done. And the second thing, as I said, it really came without warning. There was no indication that this deal was in the works. When I interviewed one of the directors who was one of the votes to make this move happen, he said to me, well, this has been under discussion at the highest levels for quite some time. Well, it may have been under discussion at the highest levels of the managers and the directors of the nuclear power operation here, but the public had no idea this was coming. It doesn't appear there was anything done illegally. Nebraska has a variety of open meetings laws, but it does appear that this wound up on the agenda late Wednesday night prior to the Thursday meeting, just in time for it to meet the legal requirements. But while it was done legally, I think there's a question of how ethically this whole thing was put together.
The Exelon Corporation seems to have the inside track here. Does not such a procedure involve bidding and a reasonable approximation of various companies, what they might have to offer?
That's a very good question, and we're pursuing that even as we speak right now. I think the reason Exelon sort of has an edge on anybody else getting this contract, and it's very possible this contract could be signed, sealed, and delivered before the week is out here. They're moving very quickly on this. The reason Exelon probably has the leg up is in December, the plant manager of the power plant, nuclear power plant, was technically he wasn't fired, but he moved on. In January and February, they brought in a new plant manager who, as it turns out, was running an Exelon nuclear power plant in Illinois. So the new plant manager of the nuclear power plant is a former Exelon employee, and it just so happens that Exelon is getting this, and I presume, we don't know yet how lucrative the contract is, but I presume when you're dealing with nuclear power, I'm guessing it's a pretty lucrative contract.
What do we know about the general operation nationally of Exelon?
Well, for the most part, they seem to be a relatively stable company without any great deal of safety problems. But like almost any nuclear power operation, there are safety issues. And one of the more glaring ones that I've run across in my research for this story occurred in about the year 2000, just outside of Chicago. There was one of the plants out there that was operating. There was concerns in a small town that there was a radioactive leak had occurred into their water systems. And for about 5 years, the water had to be monitored and examined. And there, as it turns out, to my knowledge, there's not been any indication of any safety issue that occurred out of that. But if you live in that area and you knew your water was being potentially contaminated with radioactivity, even if you don't have symptoms of anything, I would think that the anxiety you would be going through would be pressure enough to create some potential harm to you. That was one of the more glaring problems that Exelon had. One of the directors at the Omaha Public Power District, when I said, well, they have had their problems, the answer I got was, well, yeah, but all these companies have their problems. Most of Exelon's are low to moderate safety concerns. That's the story that we have right now. But I mean, obviously they're not perfect, but no one in this deal is.
We're speaking with investigative journalist Joe Jordan of Nebraska Watchdog. And let's just take another look inside the Fort Calhoun nuclear plant. You yourself have discovered a number of anomalies about the operation of it. And we understand that recently there has been an issue of the state of mind of some of the people working in the plant, and that there is a crack issue at Fort Calhoun, and by that I mean the discovery of aging and cracking in some of the facilities. Can you tell us what has gone wrong at Fort Calhoun?
Well, on the crack issue, the people that run the plant currently, not Exelon because they don't have the deal yet, they maintain that it was one of 17 walls inside the containment area that was breached with this crack. They contend it wasn't anything super serious, but it was enough for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to write it up and indicate that there was a concern there. Apparently, the crack has been resolved since it occurred, but it did occur, and I think anybody that owns a home, if you see one crack, you wonder if there's more coming, and I think that's probably the same with a nuclear power operation. Other problems the plant's had just in the past 6 or 7 months. There was an employee that was had to be dismissed for illegal use of drugs. The company cited certain privacy restrictions. We never did find out what type of drugs the individual was using, but it was enough for that person to be terminated. There has also been the warning sirens that surround the about 15 to 20 miles surrounding the plant, so that if there is a leak of some type, these sirens go off and give warning to people who live in the area that something is not quite right. Back in, I think it was March by now, back in March we learned that one night the sirens were inoperable. And had there been an incident at the plant, the people who live nearby would have got no warning whatsoever. And that downtime lasted, I think, anywhere from, my memory right now is anywhere from 6 to 15, 16 hours when these sirens didn't work. And the curious thing about this, whether it's the sirens or the supervisor that was using drugs illegally, the crack in near the containment area, the fire that occurred there in June, the odd thing is the fallback position of the plant operators and the plant managers is, well, but the plant wasn't up and operating, so everything is okay. Well, I guess they take some comfort in that, but at some point this plant is going to be up and operating. And during a public hearing with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission earlier this year, I think it was in April, at one point the president of the Omaha Public Power District, one of the managers, he made the comment he was asked by one of the commissioners of the NRC, what has caused all these problems? And he said publicly, I guess we lost our edge. And I don't think anybody thinks when it comes to nuclear power that the people that run these plants have that option. They don't have, you can't lose your edge. I mean, the risk is too great. And his comment to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was followed shortly thereafter by a commissioner arguing that there was a culture safety problem at the plant. And OPPD has, ever since that time, and it's been about 5-6 months now since that hearing, they've been working to overcome this safety culture problem, but I don't think it's clear that it's been overcome just yet. I do think it was part of their decision to go with this private company, Exelon, to come in and run the plant, because obviously they came to the conclusion that they couldn't do it with themselves and their own people. And one of the directors, one of the elected officials at the Omaha Public Power District, point blank said to me that if they hadn't gone to the private company, he's not sure that the nuclear plant would have ever reopened.
There may be not only the safety culture at Fort Calhoun, but also the mold culture that may have occurred in the low-lying parts of the building during tremendous flooding that occurred along the Missouri River, and that was surrounded with a water-filled bicycle inner tube that broke. Can you just tell us about what the significance of such a deluge would be for the plant?
Well, the biggest significance and probably the biggest concern is, and anybody who's ever had their basement flooding can probably relate to this, there's that saturation underneath the ground, and you begin to wonder how strong the ground under you now is after all that water and all that pressure. And in the case of the Missouri River flood, we were talking about land underwater for 4, 5, and 6 months. I mean, it started in late May, and some of that water didn't erode and go away until sometime in mid to late October. So this was months and months of water sitting underneath the nuclear power plant. Well, since that time, at least one study has been done to examine the geological problems that have been left over because of that strain and that water pressure. One study came back, and it seemed to indicate things were okay, but it wasn't conclusive. So a second study was supposed to be done, but there's been no indication that the second study has been conclusive either. So there is a concern about the ground structure underneath the nuclear power plant. And at the last public hearing with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC acknowledged during the meeting that that was still an issue that they had to have resolved before they would let the plant back and operating again.
Well, the flooding is a consequence of what was a rapid melt of the accumulated snow and ice of the winter before, and possibly further upstream of deforestation and the loss of root structures that would keep the water uphill longer than normal. So what are the prospects for a cold winter and a hot spring?
Well, let's see. We've had the weather around here, to be honest with you, has been relatively strange. Last winter was probably the warmest winter in this part of the country in a good 20 or 25 years. And the summer has been one of the warmest, hottest summers in memory, again, a good 20, 35 years. Days and days and days of 100-degree heat. Several states out here, Nebraska, just one of them, are considered in heavily drought conditions, and there's really no indication, you know, when that's going to change. But given the vagaries of the weather and how you never know what's going to change, following the flood of 2011, several senators, congressmen from this part of the country, from South Dakota, North Dakota, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, several met several times along with the governors of those states to try to get the Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers, to figure out a way that to shore up these reservoirs and these dams that are located north of the nuclear power plant. Several of them are in South Dakota, to give them more reservoir space so that if we do reach another situation, the 100-year, the 500-year flood, if it comes, you know, sooner than later, that those reservoirs have a greater capacity to hold back the water. Because what happened in 2011 was, it wasn't like, it didn't rain for 40 days and 40 nights. It rained way up north in Montana, and that rain and the melt-off from the winter snow that you mentioned a second ago, it all came down at once, and the reservoirs couldn't hold it back. So the Army Corps of Engineers would slowly release this water because they couldn't hold it back. There was nowhere to hold it. And so it was actually, in some respects, it was considered a man-made flood because the Army Corps of Engineers, was determining when they were going to make these releases. And there was so much water that they just kept coming because there wasn't enough reservoir space up north. To my knowledge, that hasn't been fixed yet. It's a several billion-dollar project to build these reservoirs or expand the ones that already exist. And that hasn't happened yet.
Well, I thank you so much for a tremendously detailed and on-the-spot report about what may be about to transpire at Omaha at the Fort Calhoun Nuclear Power Plant. We've been speaking with Joe Jordan of Nebraska Watchdog. How can our listeners follow your work, Joe?
Well, we're online at nebraskawatchdog.org. We're a nonprofit organization. And you can go to the website. You can sign up. We send out news releases and news alerts when we break news stories and do investigations that people might be interested in. And Robert, I want to tell you something. I do a variety of these types of interviews, and especially regarding Fort Calhoun, from different radio folks around the country and different investigative reporters. Your understanding of this issue is terrific, and I'm glad to do this, and call anytime you want.
Well, you are one of my emblems of journalistic excellence, and I thank you so much, Joe Jordan.
Thank you, Robert.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, contemplating the nuclear fire at River's Edge in times of flood. Gonna rain. Fire next time. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we continue our survey of nuclear developments. We just finished speaking with Joe Jordan of Nebraska Watchdog about the sudden attempted transfer of operation of the Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant to the Exelon Corporation. And we are now joined by Harvey Wasserman of Solartopia. He's the author of Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030, among other works. And Harvey, welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow. there's the...
Good to be back with you.
Well, there is so much going on domestically. There is the Fort Calhoun initiative, the flooded nuclear power plant near Omaha. And there is the construction at about $1 billion worth of cost to taxpayers in South Carolina of two more nuclear power plants. And there are other plants that are so aged that their reliability is unpredictable. Can you just give us what you have been monitoring about the state of domestic nuclear power operation?
Well, first let me go overseas real quickly. There's news reports that a high-level committee in Japan is going to recommend that they phase out nuclear power. That would be a huge thing. Obviously, after Fukushima, it makes a lot of sense. There are only two of the original 54 reactors operating in Japan right now, and too many as far as I'm concerned. And they have a very pro-nuclear prime minister right now for some reason, but the reports coming out of Japan is that there will be a major recommendation that they phase out nuclear, not as fast as in Germany, but that they do it. And that would be a very big deal because Japan was second or third in the world, I believe, in the number of reactors. I think they're pretty much the same as France. And, of course, France has a socialist prime minister now who is also no friend of nuclear power. So these are major global developments. If that would be the case in Japan, then the United States is number one, but the second, third, fourth countries with nuclear power will be committed to phasing them out. In the United States, we have 104 reactors that are licensed to operate. And we're seeing total chaos in the industry. As you mentioned, the Fort Calhoun reactor in Nebraska was flooded. There are rumors floating. They're going to try and, it's a state-owned reactor, actually. They're going to try and turn it over to Exelon, which has a number of nuclear plants that they badly operate. And Exelon, of course, is the company that gave us Barack Obama. So it'll be very interesting to see how that develops. We have in Crystal River, Florida, a nuclear plant where they spent almost $2 billion trying to fix it up, and apparently they made things much, much worse. The containment is cracked. There are a lot of serious questions, and that is in the middle, a centerpiece of a proposed merger, which is proceeding, apparently, between Progress Energy, which has owned Crystal River, and Duke Power, which is a huge company. A lot of controversy about what the actual status of Crystal River is. I personally don't believe it will ever reopen. We also had a big development. The San Onofre reactors, two of them between L.A. and San Diego, on the Pacific Ocean, these reactors are within very close range of major earthquake faults. And the company there, as the Crystal River, spent a ton of money trying to fix the plant up. They were allegedly upgrading their steam generator, and they screwed it up so badly that the reactors have not operated. I think there are about two of them there. They haven't operated for 6 months. There's a big, big fight over whether to reopen San Onofre. Of course, the general public is very concerned. The anti-nuclear movement is trying to keep them shut. And yesterday or the day before, the owners of San Onofre, Southern California Edison, the principal owner, announced they'd be laying off 720 people. Which is a strong indicator that they may have thrown in the towel on reopening at least Unit 3 there, and that would be a huge step forward. I've posted that article, by the way, at nukefree.org, www.nukefree.org. So we're also having an ongoing fight at Vermont Yankee to keep that reactor shut. The state legislature there has voted overwhelmingly to not allow Vermont Yankee to continue to operate, but Entergy, the parent corporation, has gone to court and has so far won some major battles to keep Vermont Yankee online, but we'll see about that. Very strong pressure also to shut Indian Point, which threatens you, Robert, every day of the week, every day of the year. It's lacking a water permit from the state, actually, and there's some other issues with the point. The two reactors there, the number one has been shut for many years, but reactors number two and three are still operable, licensed, and we're hoping to get them shut. So also new developments at Davis-Besse in Ohio, major cracking in the containment there. outgoing Congressman Dennis Kucinich has asked that it not be, for major investigation, actually, of the operations of and the operability of that. Sorry, sorry, going by. So all across the United States, the reactors are in advancing states of disrepair. They need to be shut. We just had two reactors in Virginia damaged by earthquakes. We also have a new chair at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the first female chair, and she is a seismologist, a geologist, and understands the earthquake issue. Some major new data coming out of Fukushima indicates very strongly that the disaster there was caused primarily by the earthquake. The tidal wave, the tsunami that came in, certainly complicated matters, but the vulnerability of that plant to earthquake impacts seems to have been understated by the owners, and the reason being that, you know, there aren't all that many. There are enough, but there aren't all that many reactors vulnerable to tsunamis. And so it's been in the interest of the nuclear industry to portray Fukushima as the product of this tsunami. But in fact, there are many, many reactors all over the world that are vulnerable to earthquakes. And it appears that the real core of the disaster at Fukushima, the triple meltdown of at least three explosions, four reactors in serious shape, if that was caused by the earthquake, this was a 9.0 Richter scale earthquake, which is about as big as they get that we know of, but it was 100, the epicenter was 100 miles away. And if that much damage was caused by an earthquake 100 miles away, we have reactors in the United States, in New York, at your point, in California, San Onofre, and Diablo Canyon, that are much, much closer to major earthquakes faults. And that is something this we hope the new chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will deal with.
We're speaking with Harvey Wasserman of NukeFree.org and Solartopia. And you intrigued me when you referred to Exelon as the company that brought us Barack Obama. I presume you mean by that it's being based in Chicago, which would make it one of the two Illinois entities to suffer major meltdowns upon reaching the national stage.
Well, Obama got his early start working with the utility company, and you know, that's one of the reasons we think he's so pro-nuclear. He hasn't been as aggressively pro-nuclear as he might have been, but and he has put the kibosh for the time being on Yucca Mountain, the proposed radioactive waste depository, although we refer to it as a suppository in out in Nevada. So we. But his career has been bound up with Exelon. Axelrod, David Axelrod, Rahm Emanuel, they've all worked for Exelon. So we aren't 100% dissatisfied with Obama's performance on nuclear power, but it could have been a lot better.
One other thing that I think bears analysis, and you referred to the shutdown of the Japanese nuclear power plants, and yet the nation did not descend into darkness. And so that is sort of an experiment of how a nation can actually transition out of nuclear power. Can you, in the closing minutes, perhaps tell us about the percentage of electricity and what that really is, a small part of the national energy budget, and how feasible it is to find other electricity-generating methods than nuclear?
Well, instructive to note that despite the earthquake and tsunami, not a single major windmill in you know, utility-scale windmill in Japan went down. And yet we had, three meltdowns, three explosions, spent fuel pool now sitting on the brink. And people who really want to check it out, go to nukefree.org and read about what's happening with that spent fuel pool at Unit 4. It's terrifying. And those designs, by the way, are very similar. Fukushima 1 is identical to 23 reactors in the United States. So, but you're right, the lights did not go down. They did not go off. Japan really made a great effort to conserve electricity. Nuclear power produced about a third of Japan's electricity before the Fukushima, and then they went from 54 reactors to zero. And the country still functioned. Electricity prices went up somewhat, but Japan has had a major stake in both solar and wind. Mitsubishi is a big windmill manufacturer, Sharp, Kyocera. There are a number of other major Sony, you know, people who are in the solar business. And we were hoping that they will come to the same conclusion that the Germans did, which is there's no future for nuclear power. Let's put it into renewables. I mean, the Germans made a decision based on politics to a certain extent, but after Fukushima, you know, they took a good hard look. The prime minister of Germany is a scientist, actually. I think she's a chemist. And after Fukushima, she just said, no, no more. There were political reasons for doing it, but the economic reasons now have really come forward. Germany would not have agreed to, as a country, to make the transition away from nuclear. And they shut, I think it was, what, 7 or 8 reactors offhand right off the bat, and all will be down by 2022. And but they have thrown their lot in with the future of renewables, with solar, with wind, and I believe the Japanese are preparing to do the same. And that decision could not have been made without the assent, without the support of the major corporations. I mean, the Siemens Corporation, which is huge, one of the world's biggest corporations, got entirely out of nuclear in terms of building new reactors, and they're really pushing ahead with solar and wind. The technology is to the point now where that's where the money is. I think the Japanese will come to the same conclusion.
Well, Harvey Wasserman, I want to thank you for a tremendously comprehensive roundup of the state of nuclear development in the United States and for your ongoing work at nukefree.org and your book, of course, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030.
And let me just throw in a plug. We've just published a new book on an unrelated but not really unrelated topic called Will the GOP Steal America's 2012 election. We're writing this out of Columbus, Ohio. We saw the 2004 election stolen. So this is the first announcement on the radio of Will the GOP Steal America's 2012 election? It's an e-book. You can get it at harveywasserman.com.
Well, you always do fine work, and I'm sure we'll be back talking about that, Harvey. Thank you so much for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
You too, anytime.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. More after this.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we could see? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden. Don't you know we're gonna today. Holotopia, all over God's knee.
One more time.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, all over God's knee.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And continuing the theme of energy policy, we're now joined by Antonia Juhas. And she is an energy analyst, author, and journalist, and author of the book, The Tyranny of Oil. We last spoke on the occasion of that refinery fire, the Chevron facility in Northern California. Welcome back, Antonia. And what is the latest that has developed from that?
Thanks for having me back again. We're basically still in the investigative phase here. We've had about 9,000 residents who have sought medical treatment as a result of the enormous toxic flames and smoke that was released in this major fire at the Chevron refinery. And the U.S. Chemical Safety Board that's investigating the incident has pinpointed essentially an old leaky pipe about four decades old that Chevron had actually looked at as a potential problem in November, decided not to do anything about it, and there was a vapor release from that pipe which then hit an ignition source and led to this eruption and fire. And the chief concern is that this is the third time since 1999 that an old corroded pipe that should have been replaced decades ago caused a major disaster at the refinery, and the Chemical Safety Board is hopefully going to come up with some guidelines for how to make sure this doesn't happen again in the future.
Antonia, one of the things that you have studied is the petroleum industry and the way it interacts with people's lives and finances, and I understand you're most recent study is on the manipulation of gas and petroleum prices in the United States. What is the latest that you have found?
Well, so of course, this is a national story for a number of reasons. One, of course, being that the problems that I've decided at this refinery are common throughout the nation. Just recently, actually, in New Jersey, Chevron settled with the governor or the state attorney general for $250,000 for 4 years worth of noncompliance to Clean Air Act standards. And about a fire happens about once a week at U.S. refineries. So this is a national problem, but this is also a national problem because the national increase in gas prices, which happened in the wake of the fire, was blamed on our refinery here. And prices went up everywhere, of course, including in New York. The reality is that we have plenty, too much, I would say, oil production in the United States, too much gasoline production. We had, when the fire happened, higher stocks of gasoline in the United States at this time this year than we did at this time last year. And within a week of the fire, there was more gasoline being produced in California than there was before the fire because the rest of the refineries were making up for Chevron's loss. Yet, gas prices skyrocketed. So the gas price rise had absolutely nothing to do with production or supply. It had only everything to do with price manipulation, both at the pump by oil companies and also in the futures market. And again, that's also oil companies. They all do speculative energy trading, and it's pretty much the same people. When Enron collapsed after it gamed the entire West Coast electricity market, the Enron company collapsed, but the traders kept trading, most of them getting picked up by banks and oil companies to do with oil and gasoline now what they were doing with electricity then.
The new process of hydrofracking is, as I understand it, a more expensive form of petroleum extraction and of gas extraction from shale underground under high pressure and so on. Do the economics of fracking say anything about how the petroleum stockpiles and prices will be manipulated in the future?
Well, I mean, basically what we're seeing is that oil companies have more money than they've ever had, and their resource is worth more money than it's ever been worth. So they're willing to do anything, go anywhere, dig in any hole, destroy just about any type of water, land, sky we can imagine to get it. And that includes fracking and the pursuit of natural gas. But one of the things that they discovered was, you know, basically primarily a U.S. regulatory regime does not exist to address fracking, and there was has been a fracking free-for-all, and there's just too much. There's way overabundance of supply, and the price has collapsed. One of the reasons why is that there's actually still a bit of a real market happening with natural gas. It's not quite, it's getting there, but it's not quite as controlled by the small number of majors. We have a small number of majors who control oil and gasoline in the United States, and they've had a they've been very successful at controlling price. My expectation is that we're going to continue to see more consolidation within the natural gas sector as well, and then they'll have a tighter handle on price. But you know, basically what we're seeing with natural gas is somewhat more reflective of the actual reality that we're also in with oil and gasoline, which is we've given them too much of a free hand in production. There's too much supply. And what that means that at the end of the day is the answer to high gas prices is not more production. We don't need to drill for any more oil. We don't need to open up the strategic petroleum reserve. We don't need to produce more gasoline. We do need to continue with what we have been doing, which is to consume less. We've been demanding less, yet they've been producing more. And we do need to have tighter controls over how pricing takes place. However, I also believe that the price of gas, the price of oil should be high, but we should be investing that money not in the overstuffed pockets of big oil, but rather into alternative transportation sources to get us unhooked from oil, things like public transportation.
Finally, the phrase is thrown around so frequently about dependence on foreign oil in the United States. And yet, petroleum is not foreign to the planet, and the operation of multinational oil companies and the transfers and the augmenting of acquisition by military intervention certainly must have something to say about the price and cost of oil. How does the international dimension factor into these issues?
These companies are international, as you've said. So first of all, production here means nothing about reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Oil companies are increasingly exporting out what they produce in the United States, both oil and gas, because we're consuming less and because they can get more money for it somewhere else, so they are. Producing here doesn't mean we're reducing our dependence on oil from elsewhere. But also globally, there's been a huge uptick in production. One reason why is we fought a war that gave Western oil companies access to Iraq, and now ExxonMobil and BP and others are there, and they're pumping out a lot of oil, and that's increased supply and increased their pocketbooks. Such that internationally, we also have an increase in supply from this time last year, but we have a reduction in demand. The price of oil stays high because it's energy traders, one of the reasons why, pushing that price up, and up. So, you know, the good news from those of us who would like to argue that we shouldn't drill more is that that's internationally true. We don't need to drill more. The other good news is there's some pretty good solutions here for how to keep it being from such a yo-yo in price and to keep that money from going to big oil, and that's tighter regulations. The other thing we have to do is, you know, sort of complete that picture. It's not that we want gas to be cheap. It's that we want to use the higher price of gasoline and oil to invest in public transit.
Antonia Juhas, once again, an excellent report. We've been speaking about the manipulation of the prices of gas and oil and petroleum products. And Antonia, your work is available for viewing at your website, Antonia Juhas, J-U-H-A-S-Z, AntoniaJuhas.com. And where else might people follow you?
My website's really the easiest, but of course I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. And my book, Tyranny of Oil, is out there. If you misspell my last name, you can also find me at tyrannyofoil.org.
Well, thank you once again, Antonia Juhas. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, with thanks to Antonia and Harvey Wasserman and Joe Jordan, and engineering by Joyce Jones and production by Thiago Barroso. We welcome your comments, tips, queries, and suggestions and leaks with an email to theshadow@wbai.org and 4 or 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York.